Hello, everybody. William Bibbiani here. Before we begin the latest episode of Critically Acclaimed, I wanted to let everybody know that later in this episode, while we are discussing a film called Late Night with the Devil, you're going to hear me and Whitney Seibold talk about the subject of AI art, which is briefly used in the movie Late Night with the Devil, in which Whitney takes a more sympathetic approach to the filmmakers who were working on a heavy budget. In the less than 12 hours since the episode was recorded, Whitney has already decided that he was wrong about this, and he wants you to know about it. He said, quote, golly, I was very wrong last night. I regret ever thinking that AI had a part of any future that's not bleak and dystopian. And he means that. So, just a heads up that when we have that conversation, Whitney no longer shares those views, but we wanted to leave it in to preserve the integrity of the original conversation. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Sorry about having to add a disclaimer, I suppose. And we hope you like the rest of the episode. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast, where we podcast about movies to have.
Well done, well done. You thought that intro well out.
2,000 podcasts in, and I think I'm finally starting to get the hang of it. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold, senior staff writer over at Slash Film. And write about Star Trek over there and little else.
Well, that's what you wanted, isn't it?
You know what? I don't mind.
I don't think you do.
Because I like Star Trek and I know a lot about it.
Yeah. This week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing some new movies because that's what you like. we're reviewing the new tennis sex movie, Challengers. We're reviewing the new Spider Not Sex movie, Infested. We're reviewing the new Late Night with the Devil movie, Late Night with the Devil, which actually isn't that new, but
It's a couple months old, but we're catching up on it.
Well, it came out in limited theater release, and now it's on streaming, and now it's getting more attention. And then lastly, or maybe firstly, I don't know, the order is not the important part. Boy Kills World, which is the gritty reboot of Boy Meets World.
No, they already did that.
No.
They brought it back.
Well, I know they brought it back, but was it a gritty reboot?
No, where he was just like an adult now.
You know, like, fucking...
they got the same actors.
Topanga died, and now he's like bitter about the world.
I mean, he was middle-aged, like they brought him back when he was like 38 or something, but
at that point, it's just man is world.
Man and a world. Yeah. Man in the world.
They've talked about it for a long time, but they really should do a sequel to Ferris Bueller's Day Off called Ferris Bueller's Day at Work. It's just him working.
Well, the problem with that would be the issue with having we're gonna catch up with Ferris Bueller, and how old is Matthew Broderick now?
Like, oh, he's in his 50s, like 60s.
He's 58, and he would just have to like skip out on work.
Yeah,
but he can just do that because he has paid time off.
There's nothing really preventing him from doing it.
Or you could do the intergenerational story where his kid is trying to take a day off.
Oh, and he's got to prevent him from taking a day off, because there's no real good way to do a sequel to Ferris Bueller, is there?
No, we don't need it.
No. But in any case, this is Critically Acclaimed. We review the new movies.
We have no, sequels?
True. No sequels,
these are all
no franchise
original
films?
Pictures, although... Infested is an interesting case because it's one of those rare cases of what they call a twin movie.
Yeah.
Where it came 2 or 3 weeks after the release of a movie called Sting, which was a movie
about a
single giant spider stalking people in a dilapidated building. And that's exactly what Infested is.
Well, except it's a bunch of spiders.
It's many large spiders stalking people in a dilapidated apartment building.
Yeah. It's late April. The summer season is about to kick in. We got a couple of big movies coming out in the next couple of weeks. But I'm digging this 2024 vibe where we have a few franchise films. You know, we had Godzilla, we had Dune, but it's not dominating everything the way it has been. And there's lots of room for other movies to actually make an impact, to make a splash, to actually drive the conversation. And I think people are really excited about that. They're not necessarily all, like, $100 million opening weekend at the box office. Mm-hmm. But that's okay.
But they're making respectable money for their budget. Case in point, Challengers.
Yeah. Talk about that. But to be fair, I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to, but I couldn't.
I like
for reasons.
For the 2 weeks leading up to Challengers, the number one film at the box office was Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of like really dour film about the current state of the United States. It's really like violent R-rated picture. Really kind of hopeless and bleak. We are in a great new place in terms of what we're talking about.
Well, we're talking about the political state of things being hopeless and bleak, so I don't know if I call that great.
But in terms of, like, the kind of art we're consuming, it's no longer just...
Cinematically.
Commercial garbage.
Yeah, cinematically we're an exciting
place. Did you
know
that this year, in the year 2024, there's going to be one Marvel movie?
Yeah. One Marvel Studios movie.
Yeah.
Because
we have Madame Web as well.
Madame Web, and I don't know if... I know Kraven the Hunter got... bumped, but I don't know if it got bumped to this year or next.
I thought it was February that one's coming out.
But, yeah, it was supposed to come out in like September, and I think it got knocked up a little bit. But yeah, no, there's only one Marvel feature film this year, and it's probably going to do very well. It's Deadpool and Wolverine. People want to see that.
It's
coming out in late July when there isn't much competition. I'm sure it will do fine. But that's it.
That's it.
Neat. There's no Star Wars.
No, they're doing another Mad Max picture this year. They're doing.
But we don't get that many. That's like a fifth of those in like
Tron
40 years.
Tron film. You know, it's like
it's the third in 40 years. Yeah. You know, these are not like ubiquitous. Oh God, this again kind of movies. And I think that's great. We are getting another Planet of the Apes movie.
That's true.
Although even that's been on hiatus for a while. It's been a good long time since War for the Planet of the Apes came out. So yeah, I'm down.
I thought you said Worf on the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, no, who doesn't want to see that?
A planet where apes evolved from Klingons. You have no honor.
Yes. But tell me about Challengers.
Challengers is the latest film from Luca Guadagnino. Guadagnino.
You're good.
Yeah. I'm fond of Luca Guadagnino's films that I've seen to date. Because I did like most people, I liked Call Me By Your Name.
I still think Armie Hammer's miscast in that movie.
He does.
He's too old.
Well, he's
supposed to be like 24. He's much taller. He looks 33.
He's like much taller and broad shouldered than Timothy Chalamet.
I think if the guy
they're supposed to be about the same age.
Setting aside everything else about Armie Hammer, but like I just think he just looks too old for the part. I think it's distracting.
Yeah,
other than that, it's good.
I know a lot of critics lost their minds, and I suspect critics lost their minds for Call Me By Your Name. Because it is, like, luxury porn of the highest order.
Oh, yeah, let's just go to, like, an Italian chalet.
It takes place in this Italian villa out in the countryside. They just eat apricots off of the trees.
Yeah.
The servants come in with breakfast, and it's a fish they pulled out of the ocean, like, 4 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Like, it's still alive, practically. And what do they do all day but fish out ancient antiquities from the ocean and read books and talk about art? It's like, that's what a critic wants out of life.
Yeah, and that's before the hot sex.
Yeah, and then in addition, all the hot sex. And while Timothy Chalamet is figuring out whether or not he wants to be with a stud like Armie Hammer, I mean,
yeah,
before we knew
the
what
character,
he was, the character,
yeah.
He also gets to have sex with, like, other hot people in the Italian countryside.
What was the line in The People's Joker? Whenever, like, because there was a lot of comedians in that movie, a lot of characters were comedians, and they kept talking about other comedians like Louis C.K. and Woody Allen. Every time it came up, they always say, "Before the unpleasantness," like before we knew what we knew. Like every time,
that's pretty funny.
Yeah,
and then
nothing funny about the horrors, but like,
no,
you know, it's just
the joke in the People's Joker.
Having
that is funny.
Then bring it up.
Luca Guadagnino did a remake of Suspiria, which I kind of like more than the original.
I don't know if I like it more than the original, but it is good.
It's good. Really good. In terms of like having a lot more to say, and it's just really visually dynamic. It's really great.
It has, unlike, well, listen, I love the original Suspiria.
I think it's one of the greatest
horror movies ever made. It has almost nothing to say about anything.
No, it's just style.
It's just style, and that's fine. That's what that movie is, and it's so stylish, and it's so strange, and it's so haunting, it gets away with it. Luca Guadagnino, and I think he overplays it a little. I think it probably doesn't need to be quite as
It is long. It's like 2.5 hours.
It's not even just long. It's just weirdly, like, politically dense in a way. Mm. I don't think it necessarily actually it's ever like pays off. But
echoes of World War II, yeah. And the Buttermeinhof group is a big part of the movie.
I don't know how that even really plays into it, that part, anyway. But regardless, he took the similar premise. He made it weird as fuck. Mm. It's really fucking violent and stylish. And he had a different take. That's what you want to do. Yeah. If you're going to remake a classic, you got to have a reason to do it.
Yeah,
exactly. That's a great remake.
I feel about that movie the same way I feel about like Herzog's Nosferatu. Yeah. I don't think Herzog surpassed the original with Nosferatu, sure. But what he was trying to do is make it like a little bit more of a German national epic, mm-hmm. even though it's based on a book by an Irish author, but we're going to...
But Nosferatu... Mm. wasn't based on Dracula. Uh-huh. It's an original German film that got sued into near oblivion by the writers of the estate of Bram Stoker because it ripped off Dracula.
Bram Stoker's estate ordered that every print be destroyed, and they destroyed most of them.
It's a miracle it survived.
A lot of them survived, so it was able to persist.
But he's worked in a lot of different milieus. Take a drink. He's done romance movies. He's done serious dramas.
He's done a cannibal movie.
He's done another horror movie, Bones and All, which is a weird fucking film.
Cannibal road trip romance.
My God, what a strange, like, awesome, but and strange.
He deals with like flesh and crunching bones in the horror context, but also flesh and sweat and skin in its sexy context.
Yeah.
And he's really, really good at working with photographers and production designers to create a lot of dense texture and beautiful visuals of, like, kind of mundane interiors. Mm. He gets a lot of mileage from just sort of a kitchen or, a countryside bedroom.
Yeah.
A lot of that is present in Challengers, but Challengers takes place in the world of tennis and college campuses, and there's less interesting stuff to look at in those worlds. Tennis is a very neat and clean and tidy sport. It's one where you can get in trouble, like you can get penalties in the sport for yelling too loud or throwing a tantrum on the court.
Yeah.
Like, in a football game...
There aren't really bad boys at tennis the way we had, like, Dennis Rodman.
Well, there was John McEnroe, but...
John McEnroe was, like... Did John McEnroe ever, like, star in an action movie where he had a team of cyborg monks?
He's been in movies.
Did he ever star in an action movie where he was a bad boy and a team of cyborg monks?
Did he ever fight Mickey Rourke?
No, that's a movie.
John McEnroe versus Mickey Rooney.
No, because the end of the movie Double Team... Dennis Rodman and Jean-Claude Van Damme are fighting Mickey Rourke in the Coliseum
with a tiger and a landmine.
And they defend
themselves with a Coke machine.
Yeah. Mickey Rourke is standing on a landmine, and like multiple tigers are lunging at him, and he just says "fuck it," and he takes his foot off the landmine, and he blows up. The tigers blow up. The Coliseum blows up, and a huge fireball like flies at Dennis Rodman and Jean-Claude Van Damme, and then they protect themselves with. Is it a Coke machine or is it Mountain Dew?
I thought it was a Coke machine.
It's a Coke machine, basically.
It's the product placement
machine. One of the best product placements I've ever seen in a movie. It's impossible not to want a Coke afterwards.
Or protect yourself from an explosion.
Well, of course you want to.
With a Coke machine.
Yeah.
Point being, tennis is like it's clean white lines on a big square court.
Yeah.
We don't get quite the same intensity of that sort of visual texture that Luca Guadagnino brings to his films, typically.
Huh.
And rather frustratingly, he seems to be a little bit reluctant to delve into the sex this time. Which is weird because they're selling it on the sex. You see all of the ads and it's about, you know...
The trailer was very horny.
This sort of like really horny movie about these three people and, are they part of a throuple? How many threesomes do they have? And the threesome in question, there is one.
I mean, it's on the trailer.
There's a scene where Zendaya, who plays a tennis star. She's these three characters all met when they were in high school, and they were all promising tennis champions. The Zendaya character is named Tashi, and she's like poised to be
the next big thing,
like Wheaties box kind of superstar celebrity. And she's also really rich, and she knows how to handle publicity. Then we have the two young men who both have an enormous crush on her. There's Patrick, played by Josh O'Connor, and he's kind of like the grizzled, rough-hewn, always has 5 o'clock shadow kind of guy.
Yeah.
But he's also, like, a bit of a lout and feels like he can coast through life on charm. And then there's Art, played by Mike Faist.
Yay!
Who I really love. He Mike Faist is great awesome. In West Side Story.
Should have been Oscar nominated. Yeah. Should have won.
Should have won for West Side
that
Story.
That fucking good in West Side Story.
Should have played Tony.
Yes, he fucking should have.
He played Riff.
Someone,
he
should have someone played Tony. Who could sing and dance should have played Tony, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I think that would have been a smart move.
Tony's the one weak link, but to be fair, he was also the weak link in the 60s movie.
Did we really need to be faithful to that part?
No, we didn't. And he's, like, a little bit more of the also-ran. Like, he's really good at tennis, but he's not...
As good.
Not as overwhelmingly physical as his best friend.
And you're about to get into mild, sexy spoiler territory. So, I don't know. If anyone doesn't want to know about mild, sexy things, jump ahead a smidge.
They share a hotel room together. They flirt with Zendaya. They say, why don't you come back to our hotel room? She's not going to show up. And, of course, they're lounging around with, like, open shirts and boxer shorts. Mm. And they're just looking all sexy. And she comes in and they talk and the sexy conversation has her confess, has these two young boys confessing, yeah, when we were younger, we used to like do some sexy things together. It's like, ooh, that's titillating. Why don't we all sit on the bed? And they start making out and they like, they kiss her on the neck and they all start kissing together and the boys kiss each other. And then she says, I'm going to go. And that's it.
No,
they don't even go all the way.
Why would I watch this movie?
And then, like, Mike Faist stands up and we see that he's aroused and he gets smacked in the genitals. in this, and that's how the scene ends. And, okay, first of all, the scene it takes place in flashback, and that scene takes place in, like, the late 90s.
Uh-huh.
I was going to, like, Rocky Horror in the late 90s, and I would see that very thing at Rocky Horror any Saturday night.
Yeah.
It's not so shocking.
Well, not everyone was at Rocky Horror in the
90s. Also, I've seen Dreamers, and I've seen Utuma Matambia, and I've seen other Luca Guadagnino movies with more sexiness than that.
Well, is it trying to be shocking? It could just be horny.
It's a one horny scene, and this one little three-way makeout session kind of cements this love triangle that we'll see from moving forward. The present day sequences take place in, I think, 2019. I think they didn't want to have to deal with pandemic stuff. So we see in 2019, all the characters are now 31. We see that the Mike Faist character and the Zendaya character are now married and have a child. He is a tennis champion and she's become his coach. We see that she has a scar on her knee. So something's happened. Mm-hmm. She was injured at one point and she's no longer playing tennis. And the Josh O'Connor character is sleeping in his car. Like, he's at his wit's end. And they're finally going to meet on the court. And over the course of the movie, we see through flashbacks what this match actually means and how much resentment has come. And we learn through flashbacks that the Zendaya character was in a relationship very briefly with the Josh O'Connor character. And that made Mike Faist very jealous. And there's a lot of jealousy in this. And, there's a lot of implications that the two men have a little bit of a sexual regard. I mean, they did make out once, but they were never lovers. They never did anything just on their own besides what they mentioned and what we saw on the camera. If you're trying to create sort of the sexual tension that these men are actually attracted to each other, it's okay to have scenes of them being sexual together.
Well, let me ask, because here's what I'm having trouble with here. What is this movie? Let's genre wise, is it more of a sports movie? Is it a romance? Is it a tragic romance?
It's a soap opera.
Okay, it's a melodrama.
It's a love triangle melodrama.
That's fine. That's a good thing to be. That's perfectly fine.
It's just set in the world of tennis.
I just don't know what I'm supposed to be expecting the movie to give me.
Okay,
so that was a little unclear. Okay,
so it is about the relationship between these three people. It's about the horrible resentments. There's a lot of like hate and pained expressions. There doesn't seem to be a lot of joy in these people's lives. And there's a lot of scenes of how Mike Faist is trying to... The phrase, she doesn't really love you or he doesn't really love you is said a couple times throughout the movie. Mm. and how much attraction these characters still have for each other, and how much they still might want to sleep with each other. Mm-hmm. All of that kind of hangs over this melodrama. Mm-hmm. It's not a great melodrama is my issue with this movie. There's a lot of good character moments between these characters, but I am a little frustrated with how much it seems to be shying away from the sexual element.
That's unfortunate.
Especially because it's set up to be this kind of sexual drama, and it's certainly being sold as one.
Yeah, it's sold as... Look, it's being sold as a throuple movie. It's being sold as a polyamorous romance.
It's,
and like,
it's not a polyamorous romance. It's actually a... Here's the phrase I'm going to use. It's frustratingly hetero. There isn't like a... It's just heteronormative through and through, and that's where its heart lies.
Well, it's
which is weird because Luca Guadagnino is a queer filmmaker.
Well, and it's important to remember that we need to judge a movie based on what it actually is. And mm-hmm. one of the problems with this movie is that I think it got bumped back a little bit when there was the strike. They wanted mm-hmm. to like release it later when they could do more publicity because it was supposed to come out in the fall. We've been seeing the ads for this for a long time. And I think the ads, whether intentionally or not, are selling us on a throuple movie.
Yeah.
And it's become a meme. They take three tickets to Challengers, please. And yeah. I posted Barb and Star and Jamie Dornan, which that one actually is a throuple, so that's fine, although yeah. it doesn't end as a throuple.
I've also seen like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy like yeah. on that same meme.
But the thing is that, you know, what the movie actually is what counts, and later on, after we have forgotten about the publicity, or as people discover it who didn't notice or care, they'll just judge the movie by what it is.
Yeah.
And so that's important. Because I was watching this and I got excited because we don't have a lot of even remotely positive throuple movies. I mean, we have some. Even going back to like the pre-Code era, Design for Living, with Frederick March and Gary Cooper and, oh, what was her name? Hold on, that's going to drive me nuts. Miriam Hopkins. That is a very sexy throuple movie, and it's open about it. Mm. I mean, you don't see anything because it's the 30s, but like still, they agree, like 2/3 of the movie, so we're just all dating, right? Yeah. We're just all cool, okay? Cool, great. And there's some jealousy, and that comes a thing, but in the end, but we're cool, right?
Mm.
We're fucking? Okay, this is great. They don't say that.
I wish something along those lines had happened in Challengers, but it turns into something that could have easily have come out as like a TV movie. The only thing that really saves it is the great performances from the three leads. They're all very good.
Okay.
And, you know, Luca Guadagnino has a good sense of style. The saving grace is the last second of the movie.
Oh, dear.
Last 1 second of the film kind of saves a lot of it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, don't touch that.
Well, I'm not going to touch it. Okay, but I will say that... Everything culminates in a single moment where a lot of the emotional catharsis can finally happen. It took a long time to get there,
okay.
But I feel like I'm less impressed with this movie than a lot of my
I know
critical
a lot
peers.
I know a lot of critics who I have a lot of respect for who are just deeply in love with this movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. I've heard bits of the soundtrack and they're great.
Well, I think a lot of people are relieved that something like Challengers is part of the mainstream conversation.
Yeah.
That this one is a big hit because this is a relationship drama for adults about adult characters with no fantastical elements.
About tennis.
Set in the world of tennis. And that's the thing that's a hit right now. And what that indicates is where we are as a culture right now. This is the thing we're interested in. We're interested in feel bad war pictures, adult thruple dramas, and other movies of the not what we've suffered through for the last 15 years stripe.
Although, to be fair, we've had these movies the whole time, but they have not been taking up the mainstream conversation.
That's my
and
point.
That's what's exciting.
No, that's why people are relieved.
Just want to make sure we're clear about it. And I think that's great, honestly. Mm. I will see it. I want to see it.
Okay.
Maybe I'll like it as much as others. I don't know. Well, we will find out. But in the meantime, while we're celebrating having this kind of mature adult melodrama, let's talk about Boy Kills World. Because that is not what that movie is at all.
No. Boy Kills World is a slapstick, gory action farce.
Yeah. It's a pastiche. It's basically video games, kung fu movies, superhero movies, dystopian thrillers. It takes
kind of all puked into a bucket, really.
Yeah, it's one of those. And it's very manic. It's very hyperactive, the entire movie. The film stars Bill Skarsgård.
Bill Skarsgård.
I almost said Sarsgaard, and I was like, nope, that's Peter. Slightly different guy. That's like when you find out that Adam Baldwin isn't a Baldwin brother, and you're like, no. Surely not.
Oh, Adam Baldwin?
Adam Baldwin is not related to Alec Baldwin. Just a separate Baldwin.
Billy, Stephen, Alec, and
Daniel. Daniel, but not Adam.
No.
No, so now you know. Anyway, Bill Skarsgård plays a character named Boy, and he lives in a near future dystopia led by the Vanderkoys, a dynasty of assholes who run the world with an iron everything.
And we don't learn a lot about the... Like, we learn that they're, like, kind of fascistic and violent.
Yeah, we don't...
They have, like, a Hunger Games type show, but we don't learn, like, how they came into power or what they represent, just that they're these wicked people in charge of everything somehow.
Even though it's about fascism, it's as apolitical as a movie about fascism can get.
It has nothing to say about fascism.
No. Boy was a part of their version of the Hunger Games, the Culling, where every year they would find people who were enemies of the Vanderkoys and they would kill them.
In public, in front of
everybody. Oh, yeah. And his sister and his mother were killed in this event, and he was saved miraculously at the last minute by a guy called the Shaman. And the Shaman has been raising him ever since in a drugged-up hallucinogenic haze while violently teaching him martial arts in the hopes that when he grows up, he will take revenge on the Vanderkoys.
And it's played for laughs. This is all, like, slapstick stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's harsh, but it's definitely supposed to be a wacky, fun time at the movies.
Kind of gallows humor, but like, yeah, it's played for...
It's played violent, but it's supposed to be like, that violence is really cool. Thanks, violence. Meh.
Thanks, violence.
Shaman is played by Yayan Ruhian, who was in The Raid 2. I think he was in one of the Star Wars movies as well, and he's just a badass. That dude can fight. There's a lot of conceits in this movie, and one of the central ones is that Boy, when he was a child, lost in the torture of the Culling, his ability to hear and his ability to speak. And we're at a point where he no longer remembers what his own voice sounds like, but he does narrate the film, and he has decided to adopt as his inner monologue the voice he remembers best, which is the announcer of a fighting game he and his sister liked. And the voice is played by the great H. John Benjamin.
From Archer and Bob's Burgers.
And Frisky Dingo. And as far as I'm concerned, he's this generation's Lorenzo Music, and I am fine with that. Lorenzo Music was the voice of Garfield in the old cartoon series in the 80s. He was the original voice of the cartoon version of Peter Venkman and the real Ghostbusters. He had a very, like, kind of laid-back, laconic kind of voice, but underneath that there was like a lot of shading and a lot of like really complex, you know, comedic delivery.
Yeah.
And H. John Benjamin has that in by the bucket. Like, he's just, he can sound like he's just kind of barely paying attention, but he's totally in the scene all the time. He's so damn funny. Unfortunately, he doesn't actually have anything really to do or contribute other than to add another layer onto this movie. So as Boy decides, today's the day, I'm going to jump into the Culling, I'm going to fight the Vanderkoys, I'm going to kill everybody. And he ends up like getting like swept up in a revolutionary movement and has to fight a whole bunch of like product placement cereal mascots to the death on national TV.
Well,
a bunch of stuff just starts happening.
He has to infiltrate the Vanderkoy mansion. There's four central Vanderkoys. He's going after the matriarch, who's played by Famke Janssen. And he has to like fight through each one on his way up. One of the lower Vanderkoys is Shoto Copley.
Yeah.
Because this South African picture, and there are a few cute jokes because he can't hear, he reads lips, like he doesn't sign, No, he doesn't. He runs into a character whose lips he can't read very well.
Because he's got a big bushy beard.
He's got a big beard, so he can't see his mouth. So we get to hear the weird dialogue that he sees, so it just kind of...
He's kind of missing, and there's a huge exposition dump as they explain their plan to destroy the Vanderkoys, and he's just sort of nodding along like, sure.
I don't understand any of that.
Someone will explain it to me as we go along, I hope.
And then another conceit, you said it's full of conceits.
Yeah.
His younger sister was killed when they were children, and her, like a vision of her, like a hallucination, appears to him. While he's in the middle of fight scenes. So there's this 10-year-old girl, like, lurking around the edges of all the violent fight scenes as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's behaving the way she did when she was 10, so she's, like, wearing fairy wings and talking about how she's a pirate ninja, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Also, there is a cool enforcer who works for the Vanderkoys named June 27, played by Jessica Roth, but she, who I love, she's from Happy
Jessica
Death
Roth
Day.
Is fantastic.
Fucking awesome actor. This movie... wastes her because she spends most of it in a motorcycle helmet that has like readouts of
the
like whatever
digital
she's
readout
thinking,
screen across
like
her
emoticons
face.
And shit, which is kind of a fun conceit for like a faceless bad guy, but you got Jessica Roth. What are we doing here?
She does take the helmet off occasionally.
She does, but you know, and I get the impression that it was a lot easier to just put that helmet on her double for the fight scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is probably a practical consideration, but it's still not what I came here to see. Yeah, She's such an expressive actor, you know?
It also allows, you know, a character who can't hear to read dialogue.
Well, that's
also
actually
part of it.
You know, that's actually a good point, actually. I wish they'd done more with that.
Yeah.
But that's a fair point, yeah.
Part of this weird dystopian future is that the Vanderkoys are also, like, titans of industry.
Yeah.
And part of the culling is this televised event. And, yeah, you mentioned that they have to get a sponsor for this televised event, but there's murder, so they get a breakfast cereal company, like a Cap'n Crunch type cereal.
Which apparently was not easy. But
yeah, evidently
it
was difficult to do. None of this is presented with any kind of, like, actual dystopia, like, thought to what the dystopia is or what it represents.
No, if you look at, like, RoboCop, which is maybe the best example of dystopian, like, world building, there's a lot of incidental detail, but it all feels of a piece. Mm. All of the commercials feel like they would come from a world in which everything had been privatized.
Yeah, like a commercialism has run amok. The police department has been privatized.
The TV shows that are popular, I'd buy that for a dollar. That's how low entertainment has sunk. Like every little tiny detail feels like it is of a thematic piece. We're all going after the same idea. When Boy Kills World, it's one of those movies, and you know what? There's a lot of great movies. Star Wars does this. Takes a whole bunch of stuff that the filmmakers clearly love, puts it in a blender, and hopefully we'll get a delicious smoothie out of it. We didn't. The smoothie tastes like crap. It's frustrating, though, because I feel like I can feel myself age as I'm watching this movie.
You just feel too old.
I don't know if I'm too old, because I was thinking about it. And like, I know that when I was younger, I had more patience for the kind of hyperactive style over substance, sort of frenetic, non-stop, exhausting type of filmmaking.
Yeah.
I don't anymore. But I suspect, and I was looking back, I was trying to think of, like, what were, like, the hyperkinetic type movies that I connected to? And they typically had a thought in their head. Maybe not a complicated thought. But they had, like, something that I could wrap my head around emotionally, ideologically, or just a narrative that was striking. And this just feels like a bunch of stuff. Like, well, I can't get a grip on it to the point where I can forgive how just barely tied together it all is. You know?
I'm very fond of, speaking of, like, a frenetic movie that's just, like, full of effects and complete nonsense. We did a commentary track for Gremlins 2. And I hold Gremlins 2 in very high esteem. It's an excellent film.
And it's full of a bunch of shit in it. Just a whole bunch of stuff happens.
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff happens, and it's kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
But I think the point of Gremlins 2 is that it becomes such chaos, the Gremlins just sort of rip through cinema. Yeah. They kind of are tearing down reality. There's a scene in Gremlins 2 where they literally murder Leonard Maltin with a strip of film.
Yeah.
Later on...
As he's calling Gremlins 1 a piece of crap.
Yeah, as he's reviewing Gremlins 1. Later yeah. in the film itself breaks, and we see the silhouettes of Gremlins who have invaded the projection booth. Like, they're clearly dismantling the idea of cinema in that movie.
Yeah. But even that's a point.
Yeah, at the very end, if you want looking for something a little bit less meta-narrative, there is something in the narrative where the Donald Trump Ted Turner character, Mr. Clamp,
played by
John Glover.
John Glover, yeah.
Great performance, in fact.
Yeah.
Just sort of, he looks around at sort of the building that the Gremlins have ruined, because the Gremlins ruined technology. That's what a Gremlin is. That's where it comes from.
Yeah, it was this big automated high-rise building that was supposed to have like everything you could possibly need in it.
And it was kind of malfunctioning, and then the Gremlins came in and wrecked it.
Yeah.
And he just sort of says to himself, this wasn't a building for people, it was a building for things.
Yeah.
So he had a little bit of a catharsis at the beginning of the movie. He wanted to colorize movies and rely on technology. Everything high-tech was going to be great. And at the end he says, no, this kind of building just spawns monsters.
Right.
What I want to do is make a little quiet community.
Mm, you know, like the one the Gremlins destroyed in the first movie that was also deeply flawed.
So, maybe there's a little bit of a gag there as well, but the point is he actually has a change.
There's a point. And here in Boy Kills World, we do reach...
There are a couple twists. There are some twists, and turns.
Some of them I saw, some coming, a few of them I didn't, I'll grant you. But the twists end up muddying the waters further, because at the very least, it was simple. These people are bad. Our hero was wronged. He's going to kill them. Well, in an action movie way, there's a certain moral consistency to it, whether or not you would agree with it in real life. Towards the end of the movie, not giving anything away, the morals of the film are challenged.
Mm.
And there are revelations that make you rethink what we've seen before and how good it actually was.
Mm.
I'm not convinced that those revelations, that those twists... add anything to the film, because I feel like we just sort of reveal, oh hey, maybe this is really, really bad. On the other hand, it was also really sympathetic and really sad. Let's beat the shit out of it and kill it. Like, it just sort of resolves itself in more of the same. It doesn't dare to change anything.
Some of the revelations at the end put the film in this really frustrating, nobody is correct here.
Right.
State of mind.
Yeah.
And there's something really frustrating about that approach. This is something you get from, like, a lot of latter-day South Park.
Yeah.
Where if you dare to care about something, if you dare to think that there's one good way and one bad way, then...
You're the bad guy.
You're the asshole. The only solution here is to
not care.
Complete and utter indifference.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of a bitter adolescent defiant streak, but when you're watching a whole movie that is mocking everything, like bringing up serious real problems, talking about fascism or war
in a very cartoonish way, to be fair, in a way that it's just like, that looks familiar, like not in a meaningful way, you know, just sort of cartoon fascism.
Point is,
Bison and Street Fighter the movie fascism.
They're trying to they're trying to deliberately not say anything.
Yes, I agree.
And that's really frustrating. And
no, it is.
And given how strange this movie is and how wild the premise is and how broad this weird future dystopia is, it doesn't feel like it's coming from an organic place.
No.
This is being written by people who have watched Sam Raimi movies and are trying to emulate it rather than being made by somebody with Sam Raimi's actual sensibilities. The way I put it in my, when I was writing about it was, it's an attempt by normal people to make a weird movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a movie made by weird people who have these wild interests.
Yeah.
And you can tell the difference.
Yeah. No, I think you
see an oddball just trying to pursue their own interests, you get an oddball film.
Well, when an oddball is trying to take their interests, especially if they seem disparate, and bring them all together, what they're doing is they're showing the way, because like through their lens, these things are the same. You look at Star Wars. Star Wars is a melange of a whole bunch of different shit. And we did a whole podcast about the influences on Star Wars, but just the original Star Wars. You got World War II movies. You got samurai movies. You got sci-fi serial movies. You have sci-fi ecological screeds are influencing that movie. You have all of these, like, completely different. Like, you don't necessarily see the connective tissue, but through George Lucas, they're all the same. They're all part of the same storytelling tradition, and he sees the connections, and he makes them fall together so naturally that it doesn't just feel like a collection of clips of shit that we like.
Yeah.
It feels like a world in which all of those things were an organic influence. Boykill's world never feels organic. It doesn't feel lived in enough to be organic. Mm. It is arch and fake. And I'm not going to say that there's no entertainment value to be had in any of it. There are scenes that I thought were funny. There are action sequences that I thought were cool. But it doesn't amount to anything. And it, even in a very basic way, and in that basic way, it ceases to be entertaining after a while.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even as just escapism. And I find that very frustrating. So I would like to like this movie. But I honestly think that even, like, the youngest version of me, If I saw this, I would be kind of, you know, dazzled by, like, you know, the energy of it and all. I think that's cool. And maybe I'd even say I liked it, because on some level I did, but I also think it's something that a few years later I'd be like, it wasn't that good, actually.
Yeah. It's one of those films where, this might date me, but if you remember going to, like, GameStop back when they sold used DVDs...
Yes, I do.
There would be six copies of Boy Kills World.
Yeah.
From a bunch of gamer guys who thought it would be really fun to get it.
Yeah.
And they watched it, and they grew less fond of it pretty quick, and they sold it back.
Yeah, yeah. It was right next to,
it was right next to, like, Daredevil.
Well, and, it would be next to Ballistic X versus Sever, because they both begin with a B.
Oh, there.
Ballistic X versus Sever. Yeah, it is better than Ballistic X versus Sever. I'll give you that.
Or the Matrix sequels. People kept the original, but they sold off the sequels.
That is true. Anyway, moving on, let's talk about another Killer Spider movie. Now, I didn't see... Was it Sting?
Sting.
I didn't see Sting. In fact, I actually got confused and thought this movie was Sting. Because I actually reviewed this movie last year.
Okay.
Out of a film festival. Back when it was called... it's French. I think it was called Vermin, which is basically French for vermin.
Okay.
And I knew they were going to change the title, and I guess they changed it to Infested, but for a minute I thought they changed it to Sting. But the premise of this movie is, it is a crappy apartment tenement.
Mm.
A whole bunch of people are living there, and they're kind of being pushed out.
And there's a cool opening shot, because it's a really unusual looking kind of building project.
Yeah.
I was reminded of the Cabrini Green set design from Candyman.
Yeah.
And the building looks a little bit like a spider web. Like, it's this big round eye-shaped building.
Yeah.
With a bunch of, like, windows on it, but it's, like, kind of brutalist and plain looking, and it looks kind of miserable.
Yeah, and it is miserable. Everyone there is really unhappy. And the hero of the film, or anti-hero, I suppose, he's got a bit of a checkered past, but he's got ambition, and he wants to get out of this crap. And his ambition is to sell, like, stolen goods. He'll sell people like sneakers off the truck, like fancy sneakers. But he's making that money because his ultimate dream is to open a reptile zoo.
Mm.
He has a whole bunch of, like, weird animals in his bedroom, and they all have, like, even though he might seem like kind of a selfish, kind of con artist kind of guy, he actually does care about things, and he cares about these animals. And he adds, at the beginning of the movie, a new creature to his collection. He finds someone has imported a rare spider, a very large spider.
Yeah.
Much like in the movie Arachnophobia, it's incredibly deadly.
Well, and in fact, there's an opening sequence straight out of Dead Alive.
Yeah.
Where there's, like, some explorers who find that spider, and they bite him, and the the people who like live by the spider say, no, you're gonna die, and they end up killing the guy because he got bit by the spider.
So it's the spider's bad.
The spider's bad, and yeah, it ends up in a little Tupperware container, essentially.
Yeah.
On a shelf in this guy's house.
And we meet his neighbors, and we find out he had a falling out with an old friend who's now dating his ex-girlfriend. And all of that is just, here's why you care about these people when they die later.
Yeah.
The spider gets loose, and very quickly starts to multiply. And it doesn't, like, you know, have you ever, like, seen, like, a spider egg hatch? There's a lot of little spiders in there. All right. The egg this thing must have fucking laid must have had, like, 8 billion spiders in it. Because pretty soon, the entire building is covered in spiders, and they start growing to be, like, the size of your head.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there aren't enough bugs in Paris to make those spiders that big, that fast, all of them. There's no fucking way. So we enter into a fantasy realm pretty fast. Yeah,
in Sting, it's explained that it's a space alien. Like, it falls from space. So, of course, it doesn't play by the normal rules of physics.
Yeah.
Infested, I think, does play fair, because I think they're shown, like, eating one another.
But then there'd be fewer spiders.
And also mating with one another, so...
Listen, I'm willing to accept it because it's cool,
uh-huh.
and because it happens early enough in the movie that you're not acting pretty like a deus ex machina. Like, fine. There's gonna be a whole bunch of them, and they go really, really big.
And the...
Whatever, fine.
But there's
Scary spiders.
They're scary spiders, they're really big, and...
Yeah.
What I appreciate about Infested is, you know, there's the giant spiders, and, you know, like, the big climax is with, like, gigantic spiders and people facing them down. There's going to be some guns involved.
Mm-hmm.
But the scariest sequences are very relatable spider sequences.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bit where somebody says, hey, where'd the spider come from? Well, I stored in that shoebox.
Uh-huh.
And a guy picks up the shoebox and he opens it very briefly, and it's just... The inside is just covered with little spiders.
Yeah.
And he slams it shut and they wrap it in tape really fast. It's like...
That would freak you out,
That would freak you out. And that's something maybe you've experienced. Maybe you, like, peeled something back and there was a bug or something, like a piece of, like, a creature inside it.
Because that's the thing that I think a lot of horror movies, you know, need to rely on is that... Look, I'll probably never meet a dream demon, you know? But I do know what it's like to, like, cut myself on kitchenware. So, like... In Evil Dead Rise, when someone is, like, attacked with a cheese grater, I know what that would feel like. By the way, cheese grater also used as a weapon in Boy Kills World, that's a really fucked up scene in that movie.
That's the best scene in the movie. It's like the fun part, one of the fun, violent parts.
Yeah. So, like, spiders. Spiders are genuinely moments.
There's also a great sequence where a spider gets into a bathroom, and there's a lot of it's what I was talking about with Luca Guadagnino's films. There's a lot of attention paid to the interior of this building, how cramped the interiors are, how things are kind of breaking down. It is not paid attention to. The building is neglected.
Yeah.
The plumbing doesn't work. And there's just not enough space for the people to live.
Mm-hmm.
All of the people who live there are miserable living there. And one of the conceits of the movie is that when a spider infestation breaks out, there's no building manager who comes to look after them.
Yeah.
Like, this is a big issue. Call an exterminator. Yeah, we'll send somebody in 3 weeks. Well, like, that kind of thing.
And what eventually happens gradually is, as it becomes clear that there is some kind of deadly infestation, they get quarantined in there.
Mm.
And you realize very quickly, just because the police are just completely corrupt, and also in the movie, the reason why I like the original title better, because the vermin wasn't the spider.
Uh-huh.
The vermin is how people treat the people in that building.
Yeah.
So it actually becomes very politically charged towards the end, as you realize.
Infested works in that regard as well.
I don't think it's as clean, but regardless. Yeah, but the thing is that it actually becomes very politically charged in the second half, as these people who are just trying to escape with their lives realize that they're not allowed to.
And how
just the fury that would come from that.
And it's not because of, like, a specific... Like, there's no scenes of, like, a politician saying, we gotta tear those down, I hate those people. No, it's just natural part of poverty.
Yeah.
These people are just ignored.
Seen as less than human. Yeah, they don't care. Let the spiders kill them, that's fine.
And I really like that.
No, it's good, it adds a lot.
There's a lot of thought in it. Sting is a monster picture.
Yeah.
It's more focused on the monster effects. It has a story, you know, about a stepfather and a daughter trying to bond, but clearly like a movie conceit so they can get to the spider mayhem.
Right.
This one does the spider mayhem well, but it also has a lot to say. It reminded me of Attack the Block in that regard, because that also that's another film that it's like monster invasion.
This is Arachnophobia meets Attack the Block.
Yeah, absolutely. A building project.
Yeah.
I like the main character. Caleb is the character's name.
Yeah.
And I liked all of the spider horror because it's real spider horror. I was saying there was a scene in a bathroom earlier where somebody finds a spider in the bathroom and they hide in the shower stall, like the upright shower stall. And she sees the spider crawling up the glass on the outside of the shower stall and she freaks out. Like, she is terrified.
Yeah.
And it's not monster spider. It
she doesn't even
already.
Know it's poisonous. She it's just a big fucking spider.
She's just scared of the spider. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. This is actually a scary scene that could just happen in life.
Yeah.
And Caleb, first of all, he wants to save the spider just because he wants to save it for his menagerie. But more than that, he doesn't want to kill it because he doesn't want to kill a creature.
Yeah, like, he actually is. Yeah, he doesn't. Yeah. That's actually kind of a good trait for a hero to have, if you think about it.
Yeah.
Not wanting to kill. Even and in a situation which would probably be easier if he did.
I'm also relieved that there's a few moments where it's like, Caleb, he didn't destroy the spider. He's in on it. And the character's like, in a lesser film, they'd all turn on each other and get really angry at each other. They actually kind of come together really organically in this movie, where there's actually a good collection of really well-realized characters. It's, of the two Spider movies, this is clearly the better one.
Oh, okay.
It was made last year. It's finally on Shudder here in the United States.
I'm glad it's good. I'm glad you dig it, because it's like six months ago now. And my memory is a little hazier than yours, I'm sure. But I remember liking it, not loving it, but liking it a lot. And there's a room in the building where, I guess to save electricity, the light switch is on like a timer. So like you turn it like you would like an egg timer, and then it'll be on for like 60 seconds. And then if you want to turn the light back on, you have to crank it. Well, they got to get through that hall and it's full of fucking spiders. That's a sequence I remember, because it looks like a Party City exploded.
Because well, it's not the spiders everywhere. And the spider webs. And,
too many spiders, really. They're in that building.
Many.
More than we needed.
You might say it's infested.
Yeah, I see what you did. Moving on. Speaking of Shudder, there's another Shudder film. This one didn't debut on Shudder. It aired in theaters, but moved to Shudder. But it's gotten a lot of attention. Not all of it good.
We'll talk about the controversy here.
But the film is called Late Night with the Devil. It stars David Dastmalchian, who I'm glad is having a moment. He's so fucking talented.
He's a really, really good actor.
Yeah, he was just a character actor, just on the sidelines for a long time. And then he had a handful of breakout roles in a row with The Suicide Squad Dune. He was in Dune as well.
He was in The Dark Knight. I remember him from Dark Knight.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of things.
He was in The Boogeyman, which is not a great movie, but he was good in that.
His sequence in The Boogeyman is one of those, like, just one of the best. I'm in one scene and the movie is about me. Everything else pales in comparison to my one scene in the movie. And unfortunately, it's right at the beginning, so the movie is nowhere to go but down.
He plays the lead in this one. Yeah. It takes place in 1977, and he plays a late night talk show host.
Yeah.
And also ran late night talk show host. Yeah. All the other talk shows that were becoming big at the time do better than him, even though his show is quite good. Yeah. And he has sort of like this very self-aware approach. He's one of the first people, according to this movie, to sort of like bring the crew up onto stage with him.
Yeah.
It's like a little less classy. And
a little ahead of his time.
But he's always kind of sought out ratings, and there's a little bit of controversy within the movie where his wife became very, very sick and she was able to sort of say goodbye as a guest on the show.
Yeah, like a week before she died, she had this really emotional...
And that's...
You know, let's be honest here, that's the Emmy episode.
It's the Emmy episode, yeah. And he wanted to, like, give her that opportunity. He wasn't exploiting her, but it did have a twinge of exploitation about it.
Yeah.
And his ratings, sadly, are still flagging. Like, that was the height of it, and he can't... And so now he's trying all these gimmicks.
He's got nothing left, his wife is dead, and he's just... The show is all he has, and it's on the verge of getting canceled.
So it's,
he'll do anything it takes to make the show a success, and he'd fucking sell his soul to do better in the ratings than Carson.
And so he stages a Halloween special.
Yes.
And on this Halloween special, he has a young girl who, in a very Exorcist fashion, claims to be possessed by something. Well, it's like a demonic presence, maybe.
There was a cult, and it was like a Satan-worshipping cult in that very...
Satanic Panic.
Satanic Panic, you know, kind of way. And there was a fire, and everyone died except her. And now a professor has been, like, taking care of her and trying to find her, you know, the help she needs, but she's also a parapsychologist, and she actually believes the girl... has a psychic connection with some kind of demon. And over the course of this episode, they also bring in a stage magician who wants to debunk this and is insufferable about it.
The Amazing Randy. He's the Amazing Randy.
Basically the Amazing Randy. They're going to try to summon Satan live on air. If you've ever seen Ghost Watch... And if you've ever seen Repossessed,
I was going to bring up Repossessed.
This movie is like if someone in like 1993 saw Ghost Watch and Repossessed on the same night while they were half asleep and they forgot they were two different movies. And then someone was like, hey, let's remake that movie. And they just wrote everything they fucking remembered. That's Late Night with the Devil. But you know what? It's a good pitch.
Mm-hmm.
It takes place, and there's a brief, like, sort of documentary opening setting up the what you need to know about the characters and everything. But the rest of the episode is just you're watching this episode of late night television, and every time they cut to commercial, we cut to like black and white behind the scenes footage of just what they're doing in between while they're on air. And we see the intensity of the live performance. We see the antagonism between the people involved. We see the desperation on David Desmalchian's character. And we see just how much they're throwing caution to the wind when it comes to the supernatural. And of course, it will all go very badly. It would be weird if it didn't. I would argue the movie may have like, I don't think it needed to go to a 13. I think maybe a 9 would have been fine here. I think it gets a little... It goes from Ghost Watch to Repossessed, I think, at the end. A bit too hard.
A little bit. Well,
and like... I think maybe it would have been stronger if they'd like not tried to like... We got to really give them a wowie wow wow climax, but
the wowie wow wow climax wasn't so interesting. But what I did find was like these weird underpinnings of like Marshall McLuhan, where the medium of television itself was posited as being like the medium through which possession occurs.
Right,
kind of spreading Satan's word through the TV screen,
like in Repossessed.
Like in Repossessed, but also that, you know, kind of we're watching television dismantle itself before our very eyes. As you can tell, I'm very fond of that kind of a story.
Sure.
You know, a piece of media that comments on itself. And I think a little bit of that was going on.
I think there's an irony there.
Uh-huh.
Because we're talking about media dismantling itself, and what has dismantled this movie's incredible goodwill was finding out that the people who made it decided to resort to using AI art. For chunks of the film.
Barely. It's little interstitial titles that they put in the movie. I have no ill will toward this movie for using AI. This movie was made for almost no money whatsoever.
Right.
It was filmed to... They tried to make it look like a 1970s film, but they're clearly just like adding a filter to their digital cameras.
Right. And what says 1970s more than AI art?
Well, I think it... I don't care. I don't care about that.
I do, actually.
I do not. Okay. At all. Aggressively, I do not. Because this is clearly a lot of low-budget filmmakers working with the tools they have. And if mm-hmm. they're willing to save a little money making some AI art, that's fine. They're not cheating anybody uh-huh. out of a paycheck.
I would argue
they're saving money themselves, and I'm okay with them doing it. If a studio steps in and tries to like save money and like cheat screenwriters out mm-hmm. of something by using AI instead of an actual human, then that's a little bit unethical. If an independent production that had to go to like 12 different production companies to uh-huh. get funding for this movie, and it was made for like I think less than $1 million,
sure.
and they used a few bits of AI art for backgrounds or interstitial like intertitles mm-hmm. that take up maybe 4 seconds of the film, I have no issue with this whatsoever. Let them have it. It's okay.
I hear your point. Uh-huh. I disagree completely. I don't think it necessarily invalidates the film,
uh-huh.
but I do think it's something that's worth pointing out because, okay, they're on a budget. Fine. Mm. You could pay someone a small amount of money to make a title card.
Mm.
You don't have to spend $10,000 on that. That's a small amount of money that could have been something else. And I take issue with something you said. You said that they created AI art. They didn't create shit. AI art stole something. And then they just use that. So someone's art was in this movie. Mm. It was just thrown into a fucking machine and changed slightly. And then no one got any credit for it. Not even credit. You know, when you go on Craigslist and it's just like, yeah, you know, we can't afford to pay you, but at least you get exposure. No one even got exposure.
Mm.
I think that's crap. And I think it's okay to say that. I don't think that's a good way to make a movie.
Right.
You can argue that maybe it's not a big deal, but I would argue that it's all kind of a big deal right now in principle, and that it's okay, even if you say, like, okay, well, mistakes were made. I think it's okay to point out that this isn't a good way to do the business, and it's not a great door to leave open.
Uh-huh. Well,
so I'm not saying that the movie needs to never be seen.
Mm.
But I do think it's a conversation that's worth having when we bring it up.
I think a lot of people are bristling at AI art because of the way it was being proposed. This is one of the reasons there was a big writer's strike last year.
Yes.
A lot of studios were saying, we don't need writers, we don't need background actors, we can just sort of create them artificially and cut a lot of corners, and the hope is that we can save a bunch of money and still make millions and people won't notice.
Mm-hmm.
That had a lot of just gross commercial Hollywood crassness smeared all over it. Yeah. I hated that. But AI art, I don't want to call it AI art, just AI-assisted filmmaking, if you want, is going to continue to develop. Mm-hmm. And I remember very similar arguments being made against CGI. It was an animation form that never was touched by human hands. It was the automatic or impersonal creation of images on a screen rather than the creation of something real. And lo and behold, now we're at a spot where CGI is completely normal and considered very artistic.
I don't think that's a fair comparison at all.
I think that's where we're headed.
I think that's what is
going to happen with the industry.
You can make the argument that it is, there is, and I hope not, but like, you know, you can make the argument that there's a certain inevitability to it.
Yeah,
that doesn't make it okay.
I really think I see what
point you're trying to make here, and I don't think it's a fair comparison because, okay, it was never touched by human hands. You want to take some sort of artistic purity test about whether CG is whatever.
It still needs to be created
by people from nothing. They come up with an idea, they put it in a machine.
People were really gatekeepy about CGI. They said that people weren't creating it in the same way.
And I'm sorry, that is different than putting a prompt into a machine and having a machine just fucking do it for you.
Yeah.
That's not the same thing. It's a different thing.
It's a different thing, but at the end of the day, both are just ways to create images, right?
No. One is not a way to create images. One is a way to get something else to steal images. That's not the same thing.
You're not creating something,
you're taking something.
They're compiling something.
Without giving anyone credit or money.
Mm.
So no, they're not the same thing.
All right.
I have a stance on this, but anyway, we should. Your point, I think, has been made, and I know that there are people on one side of a fence, the other side of the fence, and I know that there could be arguably be some nuance in there, and I know there are definitely contexts in which generative AI has practical application that doesn't take opportunities away from people, take money away from people, take credit away from people, take employment away from people, and actually does assist in certain tasks and certain jobs.
I'm not saying there's no application for it. And I think the assist in this case is creating a background or creating an interstitial that they would have to have paid someone for that they're just saving money on. It's practical for them, and I'm okay with that.
I'm not.
I don't think that the public will always be so ready to just reject AI-created images for feature films out of hand. I think things are going to change. I think a lot of people are bristling at the idea because of the way it's been proposed and not the practicalities that certain filmmakers have to face. So I'm okay with a little independent artist or a little weirdo here and there making something that was generated with AI to create something a little bit surreal, because we're at a point where AI generated images, I'm not going to call it art, they're made by machines that don't know anything. They're compiling images they're like mapping out colors and lines. They don't know what like a finger looks like. They just sort of compile together a bunch of images that have finger underneath.
Yeah.
So when they try to create a hand, there's extra fingers.
Yeah.
They try to create something that looks like it was made in the 1970s, and it looks a little off because it's made by a machine. And those weird off-kilter images are being wielded by some underground and independent artists to create some weird nightmarish images that they're kind of using as a basis, cleaning up themselves, and presenting as something kind of unusual and striking. That
I'm not. I disagree with the labeling that underground. I find that the opposite, the absolute opposite of anything that could possibly be considered underground. I find it just mainstream plagiarism, and you get to call yourself a rebel. I don't think that's the same thing. But listen, we're getting in the weeds. We're talking about the movie here. Our point has been made.
Yeah.
Some people are going to disagree, and we accept that.
Point is, I don't have an instant moral objection to the idea of computer-generated images in this case.
Fair enough. Your point has been made, and we're not going to. I guess we're not going to change each other's minds today. Yeah. So let's just move on. Setting that aside. Because it is, if nothing else, a tiny part of the movie. And if you can set that aside, this is a good gimmick movie. It's a little familiar if a lot of people are like, oh, it's been done. But it's still good. And I think the commitment to trying to make, if not necessarily the AI art, then at least the show itself, feel as period accurate as possible. Feel sincere. And gives the film a sense of reality that its story otherwise wouldn't.
Yeah.
And I think David Doss Mulchan in particular knows how to carry this. It's a very good movie with an element that I think puts an asterisk next to it. But we can leave that there.
I was just looking up the budget. This movie was made for $150,000. It's like super, super cheap.
Sure.
And I feel like they were able to do a lot with performance. I wish they had paid a little bit more attention to period detail, made it look a little bit more authentically like a 1970s show. I've seen, like, if you've watched interviews with Dick Cavett, or like one of, you know, just an old school TV veteran, it's not shot or edited that way. It's shot a little bit more like a thriller. The edits are really quick.
Yeah.
It becomes really stylized in some of the times that are off of the actual show. I think it would have been stronger if we had just sort of been, if it were presented as the TV broadcast.
Yeah. No, I mean, I see your point, and I think that probably could have worked, but you would be giving yourself the limitations of that TV broadcast, and that comes with limitations. So again, you're picking your battles.
Yeah.
I think stylistically, in terms of its cinematic approach, it basically works.
It has good costumes. You know, I like the kind of weird 70s patterns they sort of pasted up on the wall behind the actors. And I think the main actress who plays, like, the possessed girl...
Oh, yeah, she's good.
...gives a pretty good performance. Weirdly, that actress is one of the most recent... let me look up her name.
Oh, I'm looking up. You tell me.
All right. She's the most recent example of an actress who played the title role in Matilda the Musical, who immediately went on to make a horror movie.
That's hilarious.
Because that also happened with the actress who played Abigail.
Yeah. Her name is Ingrid Torelli. And, yeah, I did not know that. That's hilarious. That's really funny. And looks like she doesn't have a particularly pronounced filmography yet, but if this movie's any indication, that will change.
Yeah, she's only like 11 or 12, but yeah.
I think she's older than that, but regardless, doesn't really matter. She's clearly got talent, and that's good. But anyway, that is Late Night with the Devil, and that is critically acclaimed. Let's talk about our movies. Let's rate our movies on our critically acclaimed scale. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+, where the highest a movie can get is a C+, because dang it, that's above average, slightly, but still. And a C+, is what we give anything we genuinely recommend, whether we think it's just quite good or the best movie ever made. A C is average. Those are movies that are imperfect, but not bad either. And a C- is below average. Those are movies that we don't recommend, where whether we think... Excuse me, drop the pen.
Dropping stuff.
Whether we think it's merely not good, or whether we think it's a piece of crap. on that note, Whitney, Late Night with the Devil.
Late Night with the Devil. It's a C+, it's a low C+. I feel like the drama could have been a little bit stronger. It's another one of those movies where it feels like it could have fit tidily into like a 30-minute Tales from the Crypt episode.
It would have been a great Tales from the Crypt episode. Like a really great Tales from the Crypt episode.
That said, I think it's still pretty short. I think it's only like 88 minutes or something.
It's a tight one, yeah.
But I like the concept a lot. I like the lead actors a lot. And I like the premise a lot, so yeah.
Setting aside the asterisk, I'm giving this movie a high C.
Okay.
I think it's got a good gimmick, and I think David Dastmalchian carries it well. I think when all is said and done, I think the way that the movie leaves us, the way that the movie concludes, is not as strong as the movie that preceded it. But it is still pretty good. Infested.
Infested. That's a C+.
Okay.
It's a really, really good monster picture.
Yeah.
I like the spider effects, and I like that it spends so much time with the characters, and I like that it actually is about something.
Yeah.
The infestation is a comment, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to give it a low C+. Okay. I didn't, like, love it, but it is a good... We're trapped in a building with a shit ton of spiders movie. Of which there aren't enough. As far as I'm concerned. and I'm going to give it credit for that. Let's see here. Boy Kills World.
That's a C-. It's... God, for all of the effort you put into this thing to make
so
it
much.
Like weird and energetic and, you know, set up this... You get this big cast together and set up this weird, super high-octane, bloody action picture. It feels like I'm watching nothing.
Yeah.
It's like an everything flavor, and that's not an interesting flavor.
I feel almost guilty not getting anything out of it, because clearly so much effort went into this, but I can't pretend that I'm getting... That I feel anything.
Yeah,
even just the exhilaration, like superficial exhilaration, moments here and there, not consistently throughout the movie. So I'm giving it a C- as well.
Something I wanted to say, that the whole conceit with H. John Benjamin doing sort of the voiceover.
Yeah.
We don't learn about that stuff until like a few minutes into the movie. And the first opening scenes, it feels like they needed the narrator to kind of explain a little bit. Like they needed like some exposition rather than just having this dialogue free sequence. So I feel like the H. John Benjamin bit, it almost feels like it was added in post in certain sequences.
I have actually heard, I don't know how true this is, but I have heard from people who saw this, because this played film festivals last year, that in earlier cuts, there was no H. John Benjamin.
Really?
It was actually like, Bill. I don't know how true this is, but I've heard that Bill Skarsgård did his own voiceover.
Okay.
And then they added the H. John Benjamin conceit later. Like
just to juice it up a little bit. Okay.
I guess. I mean, H. John Benjamin is funny. I'm not going to pretend otherwise, but yeah. And then lastly, I didn't see it. Challengers.
It's a C.
Yeah.
I feel like there's some good performances and good characters. You know, I'm happy that people are interested in a love triangle soap opera, but it is a pretty typical story. Mm. I feel like I've seen love triangle stories like this pretty frequently on just regular television. And Luca Guadagnino doesn't bring enough style to it, and it's not sexy enough to really bolster it above, you know, your typical Aaron Spelling fare.
Yeah.
So it's a C. It's good. Wasn't so impressed with it.
Right. Well, anyway, that's it for Critically Acclaimed this week. We'll be back next week with reviews. It's a big week, actually. Like, a lot coming out first week in May. So we've got the new action comedy based on a 1980s TV series, The Fall Guy. We've got the new film from Jane Shunbrin, I Saw the TV Glow.
Ooh, I can't wait to talk about that one.
Yeah, me too. There's a new horror movie called Tarot. There's a new sci-fi animated film called Mars Express. Jerry Seinfeld's Pop-Tarts movie, Unfrosted, is coming out next week. And also the latest film from Ryosuke Hamaguchi, Evil Does Not Exist.
Yeah.
That's a big fucking week for cinema, and I'm very excited to get there, but we have to wait, because that's how time works. This is why you come to our podcast for these insights. But thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Feel free to, if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. Head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where if you subscribe, you can listen to all of our new episodes ad-free. You'll get episodes of Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early. You can get a whole bunch of exclusive shows, including shows that are complete and have already run their course. Like Holy Batman, where we reviewed every single episode of the Adam West Batman, or our Firefly podcast, we reviewed every single Firefly.
That's right, we watched all the Fireflies.
Remember that? And we've also, we're in the process of reviewing every single Star Trek ever. If you sign up for that, there's like a 200 episode back catalog already, and that's only gonna get bigger because what are there, like 900 episodes of Star Trek now?
About 900 all told over all of the series.
We're about a quarter of the way through it. God, what did we get into? And other things as well. And a huge shout out to all of our patrons, without whom we could not do this show. So if you could afford to chip in, that would mean the world to us. But if you can't, please subscribe, leave us a review, tell a friend. All of that really, really, really helps a lot. And, of course, we're on social media. I'm at William DeBiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And we're at Critic Acclaim. And never forget, everyone is a critic.
I want to go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?